Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It amazes me so many people choose to be farmers because the amount of hard work that's involved. So I'm always really grateful that there are people out there who want to do it.
That's Marcia Veldman. She's been the coordinator of the Bloomington Community Farmers Market for 17 years. She comes into the studios today for part one of our conversation about why the market has been so successful over the years and what she would like to see from a new farm bill. We speak with author Philip Ackerman Leist about his new book, Rebuilding the Food Shed. And in the second half of the show, it's off to a hydroponics farm in Indiana where they grow basil year-round. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. Luann Johnson brings us our foodie news headlines.
Hey, Annie. On Monday, the Supreme Court ruled that Indiana farmer Vernon Bowman infringed on Monsanto's patent when he planted soybeans that had been genetically modified by Monsanto without buying them from the agribusiness giant. Justice Elena Kagan wrote the court's opinion saying, quote, Bowman planted Monsanto's patented soybeans solely to make and market replicas of them, thus depriving the company of the reward patent law provides for the sale of each article. Patent exhaustion provides no haven for that conduct, unquote. Based on progress made in Congress this week, there might actually be a full five-year farm bill on the horizon. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor have both expressed a desire to see the bill through their respective chamber floors by the end of May, so that legislators can shift their attention to other issues. The House Agriculture Committee approved a $940 billion farm bill on Wednesday, a day after the Senate Agriculture Committee passed its $955 billion version. The House bill cuts $40 billion from the agriculture budget over the next decade, with about half of those savings coming from a 3% annual cut from benefits programs such as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps. Proposed Democratic amendments to restore SNAP funds failed to pass the House committee. The Senate's bill, which has virtually no changes from the one they passed during the last legislative session, saves $23 billion over the next decade, mostly by consolidating agricultural programs. With developments being made on a daily basis, keep an eye on Earth Eats' Twitter feed to get the latest updates on the farm bill. In an effort to combat herbicide-resistant weeds, Dow Chemical and Monsanto have proposed new corn and soybean products. The USDA is saying, not so fast. The agency is conducting two separate environmental impact statements for Dow and Monsanto. The delay could push the date the products hit the market back to 2015 or later. Weeds resistant to the herbicide Roundup were recently found in 22 states. In response, Dow developed Enlist corn, and Monsanto developed resistant cotton and soybeans. The proposed products are made to withstand exposure to 2,4-D, one of the main ingredients in Agent Orange, and dicamba. Both are stronger herbicides than Roundup. And in the weeks following strikes by fast food workers in New York City and Chicago, movements have also cropped up in Detroit, St. Louis, and Milwaukee. In all cases, workers are demanding the right to unionize and pay increases to $15 per hour. Milwaukee's strike included workers from major fast food chains McDonald's, Burger King, and Taco Bell. But as in Chicago, it expanded its reach to include retail employees from companies like TJ Maxx and Dollar Tree. St. Louis's hastily planned strike only expected 50 to 70 participants on May 9th, but over 100 fast food employees ended up joining the walkout. The largest fast food strike of the year, including more than 400 workers, took place in Detroit on May 10th. One of McDonald's outlets brought in replacement workers, only to see the replacement workers walk off the job as well. A total of five major U.S. cities have seen fast food walkouts in the past 5 weeks. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org.
And keep track of food news throughout the week by connecting with us on Facebook and Twitter. Luann Johnson, always a pleasure.
See you soon.
Eggs are simple, versatile, and popular. Americans consume about 250 eggs per person each year. However, the poultry business, which grapples with the environmental challenges of caring for the millions of hens that lay all those eggs, is anything but simple. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, improvements in this vast and diverse industry take time.
Wearing Carhartt overalls and a faded blue work shirt, Mark Chomlin shows me around his farm in central Iowa. With his thick white beard and a baseball cap from the local farmers cooperative framing his face, Chomlin looks every bit the part. He grows the state's most popular crops, corn and soybeans, on one farm. But here, this third-generation farmer defies stereotypes, rotating certified organic corn, beans, oats, and hay, and keeping 700 free-range laying hens to supply his egg business.
So this is the layer building, and you can see their nests.
There are no cages here. The long hen house opens onto a 3-acre fenced pasture. Except during winter's cold, the chickens spend their days roaming and pecking. At night, they lay their eggs, 45 dozen per day, indoors. Chomlin says animal welfare is important to him and to the growing customer base that buys his eggs. But allowing the chickens to wander also improves the land.
Just the fact that we've had a permanent pasture as opposed to a corn-soy rotation has been, you know, a big impact on the environment, where we have a lot of habitat for native pollinators.
He says the pasture also keeps nutrients in the soil and out of waterways. Much bigger conventional egg operations also worry about soil and water quality and even greenhouse gas emissions. Iowa State University professor Hongwei Shin is sharing with egg producers results from his recent study showing the environmental impacts of large-scale production are about half what they were 50 years ago. Today's healthier birds live longer and produce more eggs.
The land use, that's another aspect. Today's is much more efficient because we're able to keep the birds at a higher stocking density, if you will.
An industrial hen house may hold 250,000 layers. That size alone attracts attention from activists. But the egg industry seems willing to address both environmental and animal welfare issues. United Egg Producers, the industry's largest lobbying group, is working alongside the Humane Society of the United States on a far-reaching federal egg bill.
This is what my industry and my egg farmers want and passionately believe that they need to happen so that they can pass their farms on to the next generation.
Chad Gregory is the president of United Egg Producers. He says the proposal would require larger cages with perches, nesting boxes, and improved manure systems.
Housing will improve drastically, the environment will improve drastically, and the safety of our product will improve drastically over the next 15 years.
Gregory says the bill also requires strict carton labels describing the hen's living conditions as caged, enriched cages, cage-free, or free-range.
Yeah, maybe this labeling will help.
Chomlin's collecting eggs now. The egg bill wouldn't impose any changes on free-range producers like him, but he hopes the explicit labels will lure more consumers to free-range eggs. That's a ways off, though. The bill didn't get anywhere in the last Congress, and supporters are still waiting for it to be introduced this year. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. The Bloomington Community Farmers Market became the first market in Indiana to accept SNAP benefits, or food stamps, back in 2007. This season, thanks to a generous donation, the market is offering doubled SNAP benefits. One of the organizers who helped make this happen is Marcia Veldman. She's been the point person and coordinator of the Bloomington Community Farmers Market for 17 years. She says in the first 6 weeks of the market this season, she's noticed an increase in the number of folks using SNAP benefits, and the dollar spent has basically tripled. Veldman also anticipates that once the incentive is removed, food stamp use at the market will continue at a higher rate.
And so, you know, once people make it a part of their lifestyle and their food budget, that they value it and will continue once the incentive isn't there.
Veldman believes that making healthy, local, fresh food available to more low-income shoppers is a key way to improve our food system on national and local levels. She came into the Earth Eats studios to talk more about her work as a community organizer and lover of local food.
It amazes me so many people choose to be farmers because, you know, not only are you dealing with the vagaries of weather, which is just like, all right, let's see. Then it's like how you're going to be able to sell everything and just the amount of hard work that's involved. So I'm always really grateful that there are people out there who want to do it.
So as we mentioned earlier, you've served as the coordinator for the Bloomington Community Farmers Market. This is now your 17th year doing that. 90 vendors on a typical Saturday. This seems like a really substantial farmers market. We're very proud of it here in the Bloomington community. I don't know if you can speak to national trends, but where do we stand compared to other markets around the country?
We are really fortunate. I think this market is really one of the outstanding markets around the country, not just in size, but also in the focus on the farmer, where we really put a lot of emphasis on making this a market that is accessible to farmers. We still have not turned any farmers away for, you know, as long as they're growing what they have in Indiana, they're welcome to sell at this market, which is kind of unique for a market the size that we are. And we really do place a high value, the farmers and the customers, on it really being food that's raised by the farmer. I think that focus and the size of it and just the beauty of the location and the fact that we have the space to do many events associated with the market. Like, I know you've been a salsa contest judge in the past.
Yep.
So it really is a pretty outstanding market. And I think I say that, but, you know, what I really, really value is how it serves this community. It's neat that it receives national recognition, but what's really important is how it meets the needs of the farmers and customers in this community.
I asked for questions that people wanted to ask you, and someone who goes to the market regularly wants to know if there's any check or balance that you guys do on the vendors to make sure that they are indeed growing their food on their farm in Indiana. You're nodding your head, so there must be.
There is, yeah. We start by having an application that farmers fill out, and it's, while it's not as detailed as some, I've heard of 36-page applications. Whoa. To farmers markets. Ours is only a 2-page. But we ask some in-depth information about where they're growing, what they're growing, what processor, if they're using meat, they use. Information that's just generally good for us to know. But if there's a question as to whether or not they are producing what they're selling at the farmers market, it provides us with a lot of background information to start with. We do go out on farm inspections. We probably average a couple a year. Sometimes the impetus for that is, you know, hearing from another farmer that they kind of question whether or not someone is raising what they sell. Once in a while, it's a customer. Sometimes it's coming from us. You know, we'll see something unusual going on. I know one time there was someone who filled out their application to sell blackberries, and he came and sold blackberries twice, and then all of a sudden he had apples and pears and peaches. And so he don't just show up with apples and pears and peaches without some forethought.
Yeah.
So that, in that case, it was pretty simple, but, you know, it was, you know, just paying attention.
I think we can, you know, hear everything you're saying, see how far we've come as a local food movement, really pat ourselves on the back. But as someone who's on the inside, tell us where we can improve. Where are the holes in what we're doing right now?
Well, right now, Indiana is importing 90% of the food us Hoosiers eat. So
wow.
There's one darn big hole. I would guess this is from a report that the Indiana State Department of Health commissioned 2 years ago. There's a lot of opportunity, both for customers and for farmers to really keep some of that money in our local economies. That 90% of the food is about $14.5 billion that's leaving the state. I think for people who are inclined to making food from scratch, you know, it's the farmers market's there. You can buy pretty much what you need year round if you're, you know, open to really focusing on what's available and in season. And that's, I think, paradigm shift for some people who, you know, start with a recipe and say, okay, you know, well, maybe I can find this at the market, as opposed to now, like, looking at the market and going, okay, what can I make with what's available? So I think making that shift will make a big difference.
Congress just said that it is going to work on the farm bill to get us a new farm bill soon. From your perspective, as a grower, as an organizer of a local farmers market, as an advocate for food justice, what would you like, ideal scenario, what would you like the 2013 Farm Bill to look like?
Wow. Yeah, the Farm Bill, it is, you know, so much more than a Farm Bill because it encompasses, like, food stamps, the food stamp program. It includes WIC, includes so much. I guess I would rather see increasing access for low-income people. You know, it would be fabulous if the Farm Bill included money for doubling SNAP benefits across the country at farmers markets. It's such a win-win scenario because that money does go to the farmer. And it means that the person, you know, the food stamp recipient is buying healthy, nutrient-dense local food. So it's, you know, that would be fabulous. Right now, there's only a handful of markets around the country that are able to do this doubling of benefits, you know, the ones that have been fortunate to secure funding.
Come back next week for part two of my conversation with Marcia Veldman. In the meantime, learn more about the Bloomington Community Farmers Market and their program of doubled SNAP benefits on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up, Chef Daniel Orr will be inserting some anchovies into his fried squash blossoms.
They give it that kind of briny flavor, which is really, really nice. One of the reasons I love Italian food is the complex flavors that they develop in their dishes.
Anchovies along with mozzarella cheese and basil all wrapped in a flour. This is a unique dish that you'll want to learn how to make for sure. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week, we speak with authors who've written everything from cookbooks to food history books, and we feature snippets of those interviews here on the program. Today, I'm speaking with Philip Ackerman Leist, author of the new book, Rebuilding the Food Shed. The term food shed was coined in 1929 by Walter Hedden, who was the chief of the Bureau of Commerce of the New York Port Authority.
And he was thinking about food sheds, similar to a watershed. He was taking that concept and applying it there, and thinking about the food that moves in and out of a given region. He was thinking primarily of it in terms of economics. And then, you know, that term was brought to the fore again in about 1991 by a scholar named Goetz, and he started to actually begin to consider it as the flows of the food in and out of a particular area. And so it's a term we've been playing with since then, and I think it's actually really useful to us.
Ackerman Leist is also a farmer. Here's 1 minute with him where he talks about the difference between organically cultivated soil and conventional soil.
You know, the fact is you see the difference when you pick up the soils. You can feel the difference. You actually see the difference in production, and it doesn't matter whether there's drought or the weather's too wet. You know, the organically managed soils do better, and that's, you know, really most of that is attributed to the fact that you've got much higher levels of organic matter, you know, there in the organic soil. You know, so these are the things that we see in a forest soil, for example. We see the humus, and we see actually, you know, a lot of different kinds of soil structure, and that's because there's you know, so much biodiversity there within the organic soil. That's not the case within the conventional soils. And, you know, with the food waste now in the United States being at about 40%, you know, that's absolutely absurd. And the fact that when we do capture it, only 3% of what we do capture actually goes back, you know, into organics. You know, we've really got to be thinking much more seriously about maintaining fertility within the full cycle.
Well, thanks. Have a good one.
Okay, you too, Annie. Thanks for your time.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Philip Ackerman Leist is an associate professor of environmental studies at Green Mountain College and the director of the Farm and Food Project. Learn more about his book, Rebuilding the Food Shed, on our website, eartheats.org. Our friends at WTIU's The Weekly Special recently took a visit to Eden Farms in Lebanon, Indiana. They spoke with Randy Butts in their hydroponics facility about how he's able to grow beautiful basil and greens all year round.
I had worked for a number of years in electrical engineering and really just wanted to work for myself. Had done some traditional farming, but just couldn't find a way to break into that area. And so I wanted to find a way to integrate farming with my love of technology and my engineering background. The idea behind hydroponic farming that really appealed to me was the cleanliness of it, the fact that we could do a very high density production in a small space. Very sustainable. We use approximately a tenth of the water that you would use in traditional agriculture. Much less fertilizer because we're giving the plants exactly the fertilizer they need. We're not trying to adjust for variations in the soil. And the space, the land that we use is much less. We're able to do in this greenhouse, which is about 5,000 square feet, what you would need a couple acres to do outdoors. Well, I started out 6 years ago growing entirely basil. We soon found out that we needed to diversify. We needed to add some other crops. And so we've moved away from having just one product that we're producing to now where we have 10 to 15 different products in here that we're growing on a regular basis. One of our primary focuses is providing the freshest, cleanest product available. And one of the ways that we do that, we supply our products with the roots still attached, so it's still truly a living plant, and that's as fresh as you can get. I think it's important to see just the variety of crops that we can grow in this system, and we can do this on a year-round basis. In the middle of January, the greenhouse looks very similar to what you see right now because we're able to continue growing the crops throughout the year. On an annual basis, we're able to produce over 200,000 plants out of this 5,000 square feet of greenhouse space. With the technology we have today, what we see here in this greenhouse, there's just truly no reason that we need to be trucking produce across the country, creating pollution to have our produce delivered here from California. And it's so important to provide that, and it's so doable. Why aren't we doing more of it?
See the video from the weekly special on our website, eartheats.org. Basil is a component in our recipe today. Last week, we made a breakfast frittata with squash blossoms. Today in the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr is using squash blossoms again, but this time, he's deep frying them.
What we're going to do is a recipe that I learned in Milan from a friend of mine, Enzo. It's kind of a classic way of preparing the squash blossoms. And what we do is we just kind of open them up They almost feel silky, and it's almost like opening up a piece of cloth. And the way we're going to cook these today is we're going to fry them. But you could also do the same recipe and just fold them over and steam them for a healthier dish. All right, next I'm going to marinate the mozzarella. I've got some nice fresh mozzarella. Just to kind of intensify the flavor a little bit, we're going to add a little bit of chopped garlic and a little bit of my new regime spice blend, and then a little bit of olive oil. We're going to wrap these in a basil leaf and then stuff them into the squash blossom. Okay, the other thing that I like to do, and what my friend in Italy showed me to do, is to also add a little anchovy. They give it that kind of briny flavor, which is really, really nice. One of the reasons I love Italian food is the complex flavors that they develop in their dishes. So now I'm just going to roll these up, okay, and then press them together. So you've made these little tight little packages.
As he's rolling the blossoms, he mentioned a good idea to me. Since this is sort of an intensive process, you can prep the blossoms ahead of time and then freeze them for 24 hours or so. That way, when your guests arrive, you can fry them up right then.
Okay, now that we have our packages made up, just going to crack a couple eggs and just put a touch of water in there. And this is what in the business we call standard breading procedure. All right, so you have your flour, your egg mixture, and then your breadcrumbs. Okay, and then you line your three pans up. Your first one should always be your flour, your dry ingredients. You always want to season that with a little bit of salt and pepper. And then one thing that people always do is they always get their hands all gunky when they're doing this kind of thing. So what you want to do is have a dry hand and a wet hand. All right, so with your dry hand, you're going to do your flour, and then you put it into the egg, and you just repeat that until all of them are done. Okay, then the final process in the standard breading procedure is the breadcrumbs. We're using panko. Okay, once they're all nicely coated, we're going to go over to the stove and just simply saute them up. All right, so we have probably about an eighth to a quarter of an inch of oil in here, and we're just going to gently put them down inside. We want to cook them long enough that the mozzarella or mozzarella inside has time to get warm and melt, because that's what it's all about, is that nice gooey mozzarella on the inside and the nice crunchy breading on the outside.
Almost finished. Make sure you have some paper towels handy to soak up the oil, by the way. It's really a very pretty dish. Check out photos as well as the complete recipe on our website, eartheats.org.
All right. So to finish a plate, what I'm going to do is just take a little bit of red pepper sauce, a little roasted red pepper sauce, and then I'm going to decorate it with one of those wonderful wine-cured anchovies and then one of these beautiful purple basil sprigs on the top. That, to me, is an Italian summer.
Get more ideas for how to incorporate edible flowers into your meals on our website and find plenty of recipes to cook for your next feast. We're at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Philip Ackerman-Leist, Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Randy Butts, Sarah Gordon, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Marcia Veldman, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, Therapeutic Massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels, memberships and gift certificates available. More at 33RELAX or 812-337-3529. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for tuning in today. Till next week, happy eating, everybody. I'm Annie Corrigan.